In the news.
Morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for Introduction to American Government.
We got a couple of things we want to talk about today, actually four things. We want to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court vacancy and nomination of Mr. Kavanaugh. We want to talk a little bit about Trump and Russia, try to impose a little bit of order onto that whole conversation. I want to talk a little bit about the Texas elections, and Professor McDaniel wants to talk a little bit about a Senate bill that is in the news lately. So four items. As always, in these In the News segments, our goal here is to talk about what's going on, but to attempt to connect it up to the concepts and the theories and the constructs that we're introducing in the modules. Right, so this is one of our main goals here, is not just to acquaint you with some of the nuts and bolts information about American politics, but to try to get you to think more like a political scientist, to show a little depth of understanding and knowledge, to take these concepts that we're introducing in the course and in the readings and use them to give you a better understanding of what's going on. So let's start with the court situation, right? As you all probably heard, even if you've been deep in the woods, you probably heard that there has been a vacancy on the Supreme Court. The President of the United States gets to nominate somebody to fill that vacancy. This is part of the, I was going to say, I had in my notes written checks and balances, and there's a little bit of that. But in some ways, it's almost a better example of separation of powers. Yes. Because what you're talking about is that the court is its own entity. It's a distinct branch as defined in Article 3 of the Constitution. But the President gets to nominate people to the Supreme Court, and then the Senate gets to advise and consent, which in this case means gets to essentially ratify or not ratify the nomination of Mr. Kavanaugh to fill the vacancy left by Mr. Kennedy. And what we'd like to do actually right now, if we can, is show you an op-ed piece from the New York Times that ran a couple of days ago, featuring our very own Professor Stephen Jesse, who's in the government department. Stephen is an American politics expert and someone who also studies political methodology. And he's got a piece here with a colleague of his, Neil Mahotra, from Stanford. And what I wanted to do, I'll use the tablet here and cursor down a little bit. It's an article on the ideological composition of the court. Okay, so what you've got, and Stephen Jesse's research agenda really takes aim at the ideology of, Stephen studied a lot of Congress, so he talks about the ideology of Congress and members of Congress, as well as the ideology of the average voter. And right here, what he's presented with Professor Mahotra is a coding based on their judicial opinions of the liberalness or the conservativeness of the justices on the current court, as well as some former justices compared to where the average American is. So you guys can see in that center that center line that runs from the top of the slide to the bottom, that's where the average American is. And so everybody to the left is more liberal, everybody to the right is more conservative. And you see, just a little bit down, you've got Sotomayor as the most liberal, Ginsburg, Kagan, Breyer, then you've got Kennedy, right? So the Kennedy dot, which you guys will see, is actually closer to the average American than anybody else on the court in terms of voting behavior. Then you've got Roberts, so he's the next most conservative, Alito and Gorsuch. Notice how they line up, pretty closely next to each other. Then you've got Stephen. Now, this is based on decisions that have been rendered by Mr. Kavanaugh in his current position on the district court. And then you've got Thomas. So what Stephen, Jesse, and Neil Mahotra are saying is that Kavanaugh would come in as the second most conservative justice, at least based on his previous voting record. Now, I would advise you guys, if you're liberal and you're really concerned, or if you're conservative and you're jazzed by this, that when justices get on the Supreme Court, sometimes they behave very differently than they did when they were in lower courts. So you have to take this with a grain of salt. In fact, Justice Roberts here shows himself to be conservative, but not inordinately so. He's actually moved to the left a little bit, compared to his voting record previous to his nomination of the court. You also have, I'm going to cursor down just a little bit here, Justice Stevens, Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor, and Scalia. These are former justices, and Jesse and Mahotra have actually rated them. Right? And by the way, I should point out, the dots, The color of the dots indicates whether a Republican or Democratic president appointed that justice. So it's interesting, you see, if you move to these former justices, Stevens was appointed by a Republican, so was Souter and O'Connor and Scalia, but they're kind of all over the map. The Democratic appointees have been fairly uniform and consistent in their liberal voting tendencies. All right. If you're interested in why the band that you see goes from sort of darker tan to lighter tan, you can see, Jesse Malhotra have indicated, that's the middle 50% of Americans. So half of the American public is the darker band. So the justices who are outside that band, that indicates that they are more liberal or conservative than over half of the American public. Right. So I like this chart. It's a quick way to get a sense of where the court is ideologically. It's based on data. It's based on actual decisions cast by these justices in previous cases. So, and it's an extension of Professor Jesse's larger research agenda. So that's trying to bring a little data into this question about, where Kavanaugh falls. I guess the takeaway point I would suggest is that if you want to take a look at Kennedy's slot, right there, very next to the average American voter. And then Kavanaugh's, what Jesse and Malhotra are saying is that if Kavanaugh behaves as he has in the past, that would in fact move the court considerably to the right. And in fact, the new pivot point is Justice Roberts, right? So the pivot point is, you got four on one side, four on the other. The person in the middle, right, that's the pivot point. And that would move from Kennedy, who's pretty close to the average American, to Roberts, who's decidedly more conservative. Okay, so anyway, that's all I really wanted to say on that. If you guys want to take a look, the article is still up on the New York Times. I think you get like 3 or 4 free articles from the New York Times a month before they force you to pay $1 million or whatever it is that you pay for New York Times.
What if you go to the library, you can access it for free?
Ah, libraries. Do they still have those?
Well, they have coffee shops connected to them.
That's so true. That's right. They're exactly. They're a larger coffee shop. So at any rate, those data are available. There's a lot of other conversations. We'll probably revisit this as Kavanaugh's nomination winds its way through the Senate. As issues come up, and perhaps we might even have a vote, maybe even a confirmation, by the end of this class. Who knows? Things seem to move at a glacial pace in American politics, and yet they also seem to move at a lightning pace. So yes, We'll see how this one goes. So second issue we want to talk about today is the Russia investigation. And this comes up at a very appropriate time. Yesterday, President Trump, actually 2 days ago, President Trump met with President or Prime Minister at this point? Yeah, he was president before.
I think he's president again.
I think he's president again, Vladimir Putin. This was a summit in Helsinki. If you guys are interested, what exactly is a summit? I went and did a little bit of research on this. The first meeting between world leaders that was referred to as a summit was actually the World War II summit between Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. That was the first time a meeting between world leaders was referred to as a summit. More recently, meetings between the Soviet premier and the American president, beginning with Nixon and Brezhnev, were referred to as summit meetings. And you get the idea that these are meetings at the peak of governance between the two, or sometimes cases more than two countries. American presidents have tended to meet with their Russian counterparts over the years, not always. Not every president, not in every administration, but they're fairly common. In the past, they involved, more often than not, strategic arms agreements or negotiations over limiting strategic arms, and particularly nuclear arsenals. That didn't seem to be much on the agenda this time around. It seemed like they were talking about a number of things, but as you all probably saw in the news coverage of this, one of the things that came out of this was there were lots of questions aimed at President Trump in the news conference after the meeting with Putin about Russian interference in the 2016 election. And Trump took a lot of heat from the media because in response to those questions, where the media was saying, did you raise this as an issue? What did you say to Putin? Did you tell him not to do this again? Trump basically, said, well, the Russian meddling, we don't even know the extent to which it happened. He blasted American intelligence organizations for their investigations and their handling of Russian meddling in the 2016 election. And the reaction on the part of certainly the news media, and we'll see, maybe the public, is this is odd to be in a foreign country and to seemingly side with you know, the Russian interpretation or the Russian spin on this particular controversy, right? So why would you be in Helsinki attacking the FBI and attacking these American intelligence organizations and essentially buying the Russian line that, you know, oh, we didn't do anything, we have no idea about this. Now, by the way, I'm not saying that's what President Trump intended, but it sort of came off that way. And so if you're wondering why he's getting a lot of heat, that's basically why. So Professor McDaniel, did you see the press conference or any of the interviews afterward?
The reaction to it was that the people were really upset about the president openly criticizing U.S. institutions, the intelligence institutions in a foreign country, as you pointed out. And so this has been somewhat a problem where people have argued that this is unique, and some have gone far as saying that somehow he and Putin have struck some type of deal or he's being blackmailed. The fact that he seemed to be much more, forgiving to Putin than others would have been. As we know, like President Obama, like there's the famous picture of President Obama and Putin engaging in a stare down, whereas they seem to be very chummy. So it was really one of these weird things trying to figure out what's going on. And also, like I think many of the opponents say, with the America First rhetoric, where America comes first, it becomes problematic when you go out and criticize the U.S. In other nations. And so where was America first in this regard? So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because this, you know, this matters for international politics for a long way out. Because in fact, when President Obama was in office, he was not necessarily in line with, or he and Prime Minister Putin didn't really agree on a lot of things, specifically how to deal with the Middle East. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the U.S. strategy in the Middle East changes as we see President Trump seem to be more agreeable with Prime Minister Putin.
This is it's a very odd situation. I mean, I grew up at a time when the Republican Party was, you know, just reflexively opposed to the Soviet Union and took the harder line in the Cold War, and the Democratic Party was a little more torn on, you know, how to handle the Russians. So this is, it's interesting to see this reorientation with the end of the Cold War. President Trump was very critical of President Obama, and then more distantly President Clinton, for engaging in what he referred to as apology tours, right? You know, the President Obama in particular would go to countries and sort of spend a lot of time saying, we know that America has made mistakes in its foreign policy, and Republicans generally, and Trump in particular, have just trashed Obama over this, said, you know, this is ridiculous. Why do you go to, you know, to Egypt and, you know, confess in front of the Egyptians all the American sins? Why do you go to these foreign countries and talk about all the ill America has done to these Muslim populations? You know, what is that? What are you doing? And yet here is, you know, an example where it seems there's a little bit of an apology tour element to what President Trump is doing here, you know, with respect to the Russians. I tend to be, so again, the broader context here is the discretion that a president has in shaping and forming American foreign policy. Congress is nowhere to be seen. The courts are nowhere to be seen. This is really the president's bailiwick. But what's fascinating from the political science point of view is the extent to which the president is at odds with his own intelligence and, in some sense, foreign, you know, apparatus. President Trump is in charge of the executive branch, and yet he's engaged in these firefights with the FBI, with the CIA, in some sense with his own Justice Department, which is, you know, many, there have been deputies in the Justice Department that have, which I'll get to in a minute, are backing the recommendation that Robert Mueller set down to indict 12 Russians accused of meddling in the election. And, Rosenstein, who is a deputy in the Department of Justice, under Trump, has said, yes, we're going to seek the indictments of these 12 Russian agents, and the president has actually been critical of that. So it's very odd for those of us who study American politics and American foreign policy to see a president who seems to be so at odds with his own administration in some sense. And, you know, the elements of this, you know, Trump refers to the deep state, these sort of entrenched bureaucrats that he doesn't necessarily have control of. That's a fair enough point, but a lot of the people he's fighting with are actually his appointees too. So, you know, we're kind of observing this, and we're not quite sure what the long game is here. I tend to think, you know, we're talking about, you know, do the Russians have something over Trump? Why would he be so interested in kind of resetting this Russian-American relationship. I don't know what to make there. I tend to think that Trump is at core kind of a realist and thinks that it's probably an American interest to have, you know, kind of open lines of communication, but you know, maybe I'm hopelessly naive in this regard. We did want to cover a couple of things. So this summit occurred, and the fallout is still occurring, so pay attention to that. We did want to cover a couple things about the Russia investigation more generally. And I saw kind of an interesting article that was framed along the following lines. What do you need to know as an American consumer of American politics? What do you need to know about the Russia investigation? And I just want to make a couple of points here. So I'll proceed to a few points. So what is it that is exactly being investigated? So this, you know, this whole sort of Russia thing, what are we talking about, right? And what we're talking about are two separate things that are being a little conflated in the news, right? One is that investigations that the Russians interfered with, broadly construed, interfered with the 2016 election process in the United States. And then secondarily, this other sort of issue is, to what extent was the Trump campaign, you know, involved with this? Did they know about it? Did they, you know, have any sense? Did they help to further it? So there's this question of collusion. Now, these are two separate issues. And I think one of the things that I would, you know, nobody's paying me for advice, but one of the things I would advise the Trump people to do is to actually be a little more proactive in terms of supporting the investigation, right? The notion that Russians interfered, because almost everybody thinks that this is a serious issue and that, you know, the government needs to be attentive to these sorts of things. But I think that the conflation between the collusion issue on the one hand and the interference on the other has, you know, I think the administration has exacerbated this a little bit, right? So that in our minds, it's confused. But these are two separate things. So who is in charge of the investigation? Well, there are multiple congressional committees. So again, getting back to our checks and balances, there are multiple congressional committees that are investigating this, that have launched probes. The Department of Justice, so again, under the executive branch, appointed Robert Mueller as its special counsel, overseeing its investigation in May of 2017. All right, so you've got, and this was appointed by Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General. And so you've got congressional investigation as well as a special counsel. The House Intelligence Committee has been perhaps the most aggressive congressional committee investigating this, and there seems to be a rift between the Republican leadership and the Democratic members of that intelligence committee, but that intelligence committee has been on this from the get-go. Okay, has anybody actually been charged? Yeah, there have been multiple people that have been charged, although none are directly related to misconduct from the campaign. So it's not true that nobody's been charged. There have been charges, but none of them have related to the Trump campaign directly so far. So who's been indicted, or who's been charged? Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign manager, but he wasn't indicted because of what he did during the campaign. He was indicted because he's had dealings with the Russians, shady sort of financial dealings, for years and years. So Manafort has been charged, but not as part of a collusion charge. This is other stuff, financial stuff, prior to his involvement with the Trump campaign. Trump's national security advisor, former national security advisor Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty to one charge of lying to the FBI, reportedly about his talks with the Russian ambassador. So Flynn has been charged and, in fact, pleaded guilty. So in addition, George Papadopoulos, which I love as a name, foreign policy advisor to Trump's campaign, pleaded guilty in 2017 to making false statements to the FBI about his connections with Russian officials. So you're seeing a trend here. Professor McDaniel and I will teach you small things throughout this class. One thing is, if you are brought in front of the FBI, don't lie, right? The chances of you being indicted for lying to the FBI seem to be greater than you're being indicted for whatever it is you did. Okay, so small thing, if brought in by the FBI, you know, first of all, don't mention us. Secondly, don't lie.
So cover-up is really important. So if you think about this with drug testing, a lot of times people are caught not because they found the drug in the system, but because they found the drug supposed to cover it up in their system. Right. And so the cover-up is usually what makes everything worse.
I tell this to my kids all the time. It's not the lie, it's the cover-up. Right? So, you know, whatever you do in the first instance, actually, it's not the crime, sorry, not the crime, it's the cover-up. So a couple others, Alex Van der Zwan, I'd forgotten about this one, actually. He was an attorney, pleaded guilty to lying to investigators about Gates in the Russia inquiry. Richard Pinedo, a California man, sold bank accounts to the Russians, meddling in elections. So again, these are not people directly connected with the Trump campaign. These are just people who, in the course of Mueller's investigation, have turned out to have these connections with the Russians. Then 13 Russian nationals and three Russian entities or organizations were indicted by federal grand jury for allegedly interfering in the elections. So Mueller's case alleges those involved had a sophisticated plot to wage, quote, information warfare, unquote, on the U.S. The Justice Department did not say if the actions had an impact on the outcome of the election. So they're not saying anybody mattered. They're just saying they attempted to do this. And then additionally, the Justice Department on July 13th, so this is the stuff that came up very recently, announced that 12 Russian intelligence officers were indicted for allegedly hacking the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and Hillary Clinton's campaign during the 2016 election. All 12 are members of the GRU, the Russian Intelligence Agency. So these guys are in Russia, so indicting them, you know, unless the Russians turn them over, or the United States aggressively seeks indictments and there's some sort of deal struck, I don't know, these things probably aren't going to go anywhere. But these are indictments, again, about direct Russian state involvement. And this is interesting because in Putin's interview with Chris Wallace of Fox News, Putin denied any Russian state involvement. He also denied it in the press conference. So this is in direct contrast to what Mueller's investigation has turned up. So that's, I'm sorry to go through all of that, but those are the people. There have been indictments, but you notice, again, keeping these pots separate, there's, you know, sort of the Russia interference, and then there's the collusion. Has there been anything with respect to collusion? No. There are members of Trump's team that have been subject to scrutiny in this investigation. Donald Trump Jr. took a meeting with a Russian attorney who claimed to have knowledge from this, apparently from whatever the Russians were doing with the DNC and Clinton campaign emails. Trump Jr. took a meeting with a lawyer who said she had information on this, but in the course of the meeting, she apparently didn't really bring it up. Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner, Kushner is the president's son-in-law, were also at that meeting. So there's some question about what they knew. Steve Bannon, Trump's former White House chief strategist, agreed to meet with Mueller as part of his investigation. So there's some speculation that maybe Bannon is involved in this. Sessions, Jeff Sessions, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have already met with Mueller. So there are people in the Trump administration from the Trump campaign who have met with Mueller, but it's not at all clear what's going on. Now, what about Trump? Trump says he's looking forward to being questioned by Mueller under oath. I'm not an attorney. I would strongly advise him not to do this. I think he asked former President Clinton about testifying in front of these special investigators. The problem with, you know, a president going in front of a special investigator or to the FBI is that everything you say, anything that's loose, anything that is inconsistent, then has the potential to be considered perjury, lying under oath, even misremembering. Can be considered, you know, obstruction of justice, lying under oath, perjury. Again, it's sort of the reaction, not necessarily the crime. So I don't know who's advising him. You know, I think Trump is very concerned about how it looks.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to testify to show he has nothing to hide. But any lawyer worth their grain will tell you, just don't do this. Clients don't testify under oath unless you absolutely have to. So why is this stuff also controversial? Well, Trump has been very critical of Mueller. Remember, Mueller was appointed by Jeff Sessions. He said his friendship, Mueller's friendship with James Comey, the FBI director, is, quote, very bothersome. This is Trump's quote. Multiple investigators on Mueller's team have faced question about their potential political biases, and Trump keeps pointing this out. The House Republicans released a memo in early February 2018. That detailed alleged surveillance abuses in the Russia probe. So this is, you know, the United States government engaged in abusive surveillance techniques. So all of this has kind of come up, which is the activities of the government investigating, you know, Russian interference have come under scrutiny and come under attack. And, you know, you might ask, like, how did this Russian meddling stuff even begin? You know, before Trump even took office, right? This is during the campaign, the Russians were sort of systematically Now, the media keeps saying hacking. There was some hacking, but the most of the stuff they're involved with involved sort of misinformation, trying to plant stories and things like that. There was some hacking, and that was Democratic emails, Democratic servers, and this information showed, you know, sort of embarrassing stuff about Hillary Clinton. Why the heck are the Russians doing this? You know, some people say it's because they like Trump and they wanted Trump because they had something on him. I would go the opposite way on this. It's pretty clear Putin doesn't like Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Clinton did some things when she was Secretary of State that Putin didn't like, made statements about a lot of the activities the Russians were engaged in. Putin does not like Hillary Clinton. It seems to me they're really trying to embarrass Hillary Clinton. And if Trump was the beneficiary more. Now, again, maybe I'm naive, but, you know, that seems to be at least as important a fact. So that's as best we can do in about 12 minutes, what we can tell you about the Russia probe and the Russia investigation. And it is ongoing. Mueller, when you put a special investigator, a special counsel, when you empower them, the president can fire them, technically, and there's been some speculation about Trump perhaps doing that. I wouldn't expect that. These positions tend to have a life of their own. We've had multiple special investigators or counsels in the past. They tend to go until, you know, they, you know, reach some resolution in their investigation. So anyway, we have that to look forward to throughout the summer. So two final things we want to talk about before we go to our TAs. I just want to really briefly talk about the Texas elections coming up. So we're going to go from, you know, the national stuff on the Supreme Court to this international broad geopolitics stuff. Let's bring it back to the state and some more local politics. So Real Clear Politics runs an average of all the available polling information that you're going to find for statewide races. And I wanted to just point out that this 2018, November 2018, there is a midterm election. In Texas, all of the statewide offices are going to be up. So the entire Texas state legislature, half of the Texas Senate seats, Texas Senate's on staggered terms, half is up every 2 years, and then the other half is up the next 2 years. You're going to have a Senate election. Ted Cruz's seat is up, and that's the polling data I have for you right here. So I always like this because it's showing 6 polls. This is all the available polling information we have on the Texas Senate race. And you'll see the dates the polls were done, the samples, how many people were interviewed, whether it was a likely voter versus a registered voter sample, the margin of error. And what you can see is here's Ted Cruz. The last 5 polls show Cruz at 51, 50, 41. That's the UT Trib poll, 50 and 47. And then Beto O'Rourke, 42, 40, 36, 39, 40. So if you go up to the average, you see the Cruz is averaging 48%. O'Rourke is averaging 39%. So about an 8.5-point spread on average. So if you want a sense of the state of the race, right now you say Cruz is up about 8 points, which is actually pretty good for a Democrat in Texas. You know, it doesn't get you elected, but it puts you within striking distance. And who knows what can happen if the bottom falls out for Trump, if Cruz does something that's, you know, particularly offensive or makes a big error. You know, maybe O'Rourke is positioned to be the first Democrat since 1994 to win a statewide race. Let me go up real quickly here because we also have, we've got the Cruz seat, but we also have the governor race. Let me see if I can get that here. Valdez and Abbott. And once again, if we go down, we can take a look at Abbott up 10, 12, 19, and 12 in the last 4 polls, which equates to an average spread of about 13 points. So we'll go ahead and just get out of there, and we'll just talk about it here for a second. Okay, so what you're seeing in the polls then is O'Rourke trailing Cruz by about 8.5 points, Valdez trailing Abbott by 12 or 13. So if you're interested in you know, what is the difference between sort of an effective, aggressive candidate and campaign, which I think most of us would say O'Rourke is, versus, you know, a candidate maybe, you know, less popular, a little less aggressive, a little less intent, maybe not running as high quality campaign, I think most people see Valdez has been a little lackluster so far. She's got time, but so far not so great. It looks to be about 5 points or so. Right, I mean, that's the difference now between Abbott and Cruz in the polls. Both the Republicans look like they're in pretty good shape, but as we said, it's summer. You know, there's 4 months until Election Day. There's a lot of time. In addition, so you've not only got the Senate race, which is, of course, a federal race, the Gov race. We wanted to point out the lieutenant governor will be elected. We have Dan Patrick, the incumbent Republican, running against Democrat Mike Collier. The Texas attorney general race, which is Ken Paxton, the incumbent Republican, running against Justin Nelson, who's the Democrat. And then the other race I think is going to be interesting is the land commissioner race. We elect the land commissioner. All these executive offices in Texas are elected. So, you know, the president appoints these positions and, you know, they constitute his cabinet. In Texas, the executive is by and large a series of elected positions. And the Texas Land Commission race will be George P. Bush. So Jeb's son is running, a Republican running for re-election against Miguel Suazo, the Democrat. And George P. has had some, you know, some problems. He had some difficulty with the way he managed the Alamo. And you know, one thing you need to know about Texas politics, you can mess with a lot of different things. You can screw up a lot of different things in Texas, but you can't screw up the Alamo. Yeah. That tends to be politically consequential. So George P., obviously, though, a big name, you know, iconic family in Texas politics, his career seems to have stalled out a little bit, and we'll see if he can win re-election in that land commissioner position. So those are kind of five races to watch. The Senate, the Gov, Light Gov, Lieutenant Governor, Attorney General, Land Commissioner race in Texas, and that Real Clear Politics average has good polling information if you're interested in how things are shaking out. So that's my last little tidbit. Professor McDaniel, you had something you wanted to talk about, though.
So one final thing that we want to mention is a court case that's going on right now regarding a bill that was passed in the Senate in 2017. And so Senate Bill 8 required health providers to either perform a burial or cremation of fetal remains. And so if a woman had an abortion, that the healthcare provider would then be required to either have a burial or a cremation of the remains. And it's been argued as an issue of dignity regarding this. And so those who are pro-life argue that there needs to be some dignity surrounded by this. It should not just be cast away. Whereas those who are pro-choice have argued that this is just a way of making abortions more expensive because the cost of the cremation and burial will be passed on to the woman who's receiving this service. Now, what's important to note about this is that the Texas Department of State Health Services actually had a rule regarding this earlier on, but it was struck down in the federal courts. But then the Senate passed this, and now it is under an injunction, so it cannot be, it was supposed to go into effect in February, but an injunction went into place in January, and now it's being argued in the courts about whether or not this is legal. And this story is really important because, one, it tells us a story about the role of the courts in balancing what's going on within the legislature. And so you have the governor of the legislature saying, no, this should happen. But the court saying, well, is this really legal? Should this be allowed to happen? But also you have an issue of federalism where you're seeing that the state is making a decision, but you have the federal courts stepping in to say, well, does this violate federal laws, things of that nature. And so you have, again, an issue of checks and balances between the judiciary and the executive and legislative branch. But also you have a federal case here where you have the federal government's discussion of state activities. And so while we won't talk about the issues of the legislature, executive branch, and the courts until the second module, what we are talking about this first module is federalism. And really, a lot of the issues dealing with federalism are handled in the courts. And you'll find that a lot of times when there is a challenge of certain state laws, they take it to the federal courts. So if you think of Brown v. Board, you think of a variety of decisions that have come about, it's people are challenging what the state is doing in the federal courts. And this is the same thing you see happening here. But in addition, this is also what people refer to as venue shopping, where you see that, okay, you may not be successful at the state level, but you may have more success at the federal level. And in many times, people are trying to control where they're going to wage political battles. So they want to wage it somewhere where they know they have a good chance of winning. And so if you think about my discussion of E.E. Schatzschneider and really in the early lecture about controlling the scope of conflict, again, those who are pro-life would have liked this to stay at the state level because they know they have the most power there. Those who are pro-choice want to move this up to the federal level because they think they may have a way to win there. And so again, this is how we see these political conflicts come into play and how this shapes things. And so we're seeing, again, an issue of the institutions interacting with each other, but also an interaction between the state government and federal government. And so these are things to be aware of that closely tie into things that we're already talking about in this first module.
Yeah, I'd just say to kind of piggyback on what Professor McDaniel's saying, I'll take it to the Supreme Court level. Tie it back to the discussion we had about Kavanaugh. One of the things that Democrats are most concerned about, liberals, progressives are concerned about is, you know, if you have a court that's more conservative, you know, might you see erosion of a woman's right to choose, abortion rights, however you want to style it, and perhaps even an overturning of Roe v. Wade, the seminal case where a right to privacy was established and held to protect a woman's right to choose. Well, you know, one thing I would point out is that if that were to happen, if Kavanaugh were to be sworn in and the court were to reconsider Roe v. Wade and to overturn it, to say that there is no constitutional right to an abortion, there's no specific right to privacy that protects a woman's right to choose, that doesn't mean that abortions, you know, are outlawed in the United States. In fact, what it would mean is that there would be no declared constitutional right. So you would either get a constitutional amendment establishing that right, or congressional legislation establishing that right, or state-by-state laws establishing or knocking the edges off of that right. So, you know, one of the interesting things here is that the Republicans and the sort of conservative position on the court, in a lot, I'm not arguing that it's not consequential, but I think it's an overstatement to think that Republicans sort of knocking out some of these established rights that have been asserted by, say, the Warren Court or the Berger Court or even the Rehnquist Court, if Republicans were to take those back and to say, like, well, those aren't actually constitutional rights, you know, they're not explicitly in the Constitution, that simply would, and again, I'm not saying this is a great thing, but it would mean the Congress has to act. Right? There's nothing that says, you know, you can't have a constitutional amendment or congressional legislation on these things, but it would force Congress to step up and act. And one of the interesting things you've seen in American politics, whether it's immigration or, you know, some of these court cases, you know, LGBTQ rights, is that the executive, President Obama, expressed his frustration, you know, if Congress won't act, I will. Trump has done kind of the same thing in a lot of ways. Presidents, when they get into office, get very frustrated with Congress. Congress doesn't seem to act. The courts and the president have been, in a lot of ways, the locus of, you know, a lot of this rights establishment and protections. You know, a more conservative court, you know, would put the onus back on Congress. And, you know, who knows whether Congress could get its act together to do some of these things. So with that, I think we're done substantively with our In the News segment, and we will see you next week.
The Government 310 In the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.